This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. When Clinton ran for president, he promised to end the ban against homosexuals in the military. Once in office, he was forced to compromise and offered a solution which allows gays and lesbians to serve if they keep their sexual orientation a secret. This policy is called Don't Ask, Don't Tell, Don't Pursue. It didn't satisfy the gay rights community or the military, but appeared to break the impasse between the two sides. The man behind this new policy is military sociologist Charles Moskos. For the past 30 years, he has followed the U.S. Army to almost every war and conflict, where he has done exhaustive research on the culture of military life. He's known for his groundbreaking studies on race relations. He currently teaches at Northwestern University. Moskos is also the architect of President Clinton's National Service Program, which he says will give to civilian society some of the same civic values that the military provides for its members. We spoke earlier today about the new Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. He said it will make life easier for homosexuals serving in the armed forces.
Well, remember, nobody's supposed to ask anybody a question about sexual orientation. If a gay person, however, wants to wear his or her sexuality on their sleeve, then they will be discharged from the service. That's where the compromise comes down. Remember, on the other side, you have to think, Marty, of the we don't mix men and women on a forcible basis on any kind of environment except perhaps concentration camps. We don't do that in jails. We don't do that in freshman dorms. We don't do that in the military. There's a somewhat of the parallel there is mixing people forcibly of different sexual orientations in an open fashion. The compromise prevents that, too, and it seeks to draw the analogy between men and women.
But does it prevent that? Because what the policy seems to say is that you can, if you're gay or lesbian, serve in the military. So how does that preserve the sexual privacy of heterosexuals?
Because people won't know it. That's how obviously there are gays and lesbians serving today and in the past. My own company commander, by the way, over 25 years ago was a gay. This has gone on historically in the military. It's never been a major problem because of the necessity for being very discreet about it. The compromise continues that discretion. Let me add one other thing, Marty. I think it's important here.
Go ahead.
You've been mentioning gays and lesbians. This is largely a male issue, though obviously it applies to both sexes. Our surveys conducted exhaustively among male and female soldiers showed us the male soldiers were most concerned and exercised over the gay ban. For women, if we had an all-female force, we wouldn't be having this conversation. Women are much less concerned. And I think it comes down to the gut reality that we males, you know, are the insecure sex, and therefore issues of heterosexuality, homosexuality are much more salient.
It's an interesting point you made, though. Does this policy reward male soldiers' insecurity or even reward their prejudices?
Well, you might say that if a woman doesn't want to shower forcibly with a male, and we say, by the way, we're not going to make you do that, does that reward her prejudices? Does that reward her insecurities? It's the same analogy applies.
Let me ask you something else, because part of the military code still stands, which is it still says that homosexuality is incompatible with military service. Does this new policy, though, somehow undermine that if gays and lesbians are being allowed to serve in the military?
Open gays and lesbians are not being allowed to serve. Gays and lesbians are being allowed to serve. Gays and lesbians, of course, were not allowed to serve in the previous regulation, you know, before January 1993. Any inclination or statement or insinuation of a homosexual sexual orientation was sufficient for discharge. This one now, no more seeking will go on. Mm-hmm. And I guess the real issue is that it makes life for the serving gay much easier, while it doesn't really attend to the gay agenda in the larger society. But we're really focusing here on serving members, gay and straight. We don't want to forget the straights who also have rights. And that's why the compromise has come about.
Well, certainly members of the gay and lesbian community that have been critical of this new policy say that it really doesn't make their life that much easier because they still have to hide so much of their identity.
Absolutely, and that's the way it is. In the meantime, there'll be a lot of straights who are going to be uncomfortable with thinking that gays and will be, you know, in their units sharing intimate living quarters. We're only hearing one side of the story here. Mm-hmm. Remember, there are two rights in collision here, and that's why a compromise was necessary.
Do you see this policy as a first step towards a more open policy at some future date?
Many of the conservatives fear that. I mean, there are many people who oppose this compromise for reasons that haven't been raised yet, and that's because on the right, There are people who see this as opening the door. This is the beginning of a slippery slope. Therefore, they really wanted to keep the old ban in effect. What makes our country unique, Marty, and that's why we're the only one that really faces it in the sense that of our discussion, we're the only nation in the world with a strong religious right and also, and at the same time a very active gay advocacy community, which doesn't consist just of gays but also others, you know, who follow and sympathize with the gay equal rights movement. The fact that we have these two sort of polar opposites, both having political clout, both having media influence, means that we are unique in the world, and that's therefore we're the one who come up with a relatively unique compromise. By the way, no country in the world that we know of, any, you know, speaking of advanced democracies in Europe or Israel, Canada, Australia, places of this sort, treat gays and straights exactly the same in the military. There's no country that does that.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I know that Senator Barney Frank had offered as a compromise was to say, let's divide behavior in half. Let's say that on the base that everyone has to abide by a strict code, but behavior off the base and out of uniform, gays and lesbians could live their gay and lesbian lifestyle. Do you think that would have worked as a compromise in the military?
Well, you know, Congressman Frank's, his version of don't ask, don't tell, as he stated himself, was because he realized the full lifting of the ban was not possible. He was attacked, I might add, by many gay advocates for compromising too quickly on the issue. De facto, we are going to be doing that. Off-base, discreet behavior is not going to be sought out or punished. Though, by the strict letter of the regulation, if somebody comes out or flaunts it, they will be discharged. Right. But de facto, we're going to have very much the situation Barney Frank envisioned.
Well, this new policy is being challenged in court. The ACLU has filed suit on issues of First Amendment and on equal protection clause. How do you think this will get played out?
They'll be turned down. This is a very talking to gay advocate lawyers groups. They're very leery of that ACLU because they're going to get on very treacherous ground. Most likely, they'll lose. Courts have traditionally deferred to the military with regards to rights and responsibilities and free speech and the rest. That's not the area and the terrain to take this case to, and it may set up bad precedents which then can domino effect backwards, you know, into the civilian sphere. I think many anti-gay people are silently cheering the ACLU on into taking this in these treacherous waters. It's very ill-advised.
What?
If I were a gay person, I would be petrified by that action.
Explain a little bit more what you mean by that.
Because they'll lose, most likely, in trying to talk about free speech in the military environment, and that in turn could have bad precedents for civilian activity as well. This may boomerang. I would just let this alone. This has never been a major agenda, and you'd have to ask gay advocates to speak more precisely to this. Never been a major agenda. It became one inadvertently through the promise of the then candidate Clinton, and then his early actions in the first weeks of his administration. It's really not the place to fight gay rights battles.
I'm curious if President Clinton had ordered that homosexuals be allowed to serve alongside heterosexuals as Black Americans do today. What would have happened in the military?
What would have happened, of course, nothing, because Congress would have immediately passed a law codifying the ban, and then President Clinton would have had to either veto that bill or even have his veto overridden. Now, he could have gone down in flames and said, well, I did my best. I was overridden. Congress has now passed a law maintaining the ban, making a few points, but then nothing would have changed. Under the compromise, everybody's a little bit better off than they were before January 1993. This is a compromise with no winners or losers, but it seems that most people are agreed. And apparently, you know, public opinion surveys show large support for the don't ask, don't tell rule as well. So this is where the country is as well, and that's a very important factor.
Do you think there are any lessons that could be learned from integrating African Americans into the military that could be or have been applied to gays and lesbians? Do you see them as equivalent issues?
No, and this is usually an argument raised by white people. Most Black Americans take affront at this. Survey data also show, for better or for worse, most Black Americans are harder lined on gay issues than are white Americans. And I think their ultimate question is this. Sexuality, hetero or homo, is an essence of a person's identity. For people to use the race analogy then argues that race is the essence of somebody. Race is not the essence of a person's identity. Sexuality is certainly one, and there are other personality variables as well. And what we have to recognize here is that when blacks were integrated into the military in the early 1950s, it was done specifically to improve military efficiency. Had we had not an integrated military, and I've written extensively on this, we would not have an effective military today. We would not have a military which enjoys the legitimacy it does enjoy in the broader community. Nobody has seriously argued that opening up, for example, combat roles to women, which is another, you know, controversial issue, or allowing open homosexuals into the military is going to improve military performance. Rather, the arguments are made on civil rights grounds. The races were integrated not because we were nice guys, but because we had to do it simply to keep an effective military operating.
Well, I want to talk some more, but first we have to take a short break. My guest is Charles Moskos. He's a military sociologist, a professor of sociology at Northwestern University in Illinois, and chairman of the Inter-University Seminar on Armed Forces and Society. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is military sociologist Charles Moskos. Let me talk a little bit about President Clinton's relationship with the military. How would you describe it?
The president's relations with the military is not the greatest. It's somewhat tense. It's for a variety of reasons. One reason, of course, is, as we were discussing earlier in the program, the president's position on allowing open gays in the military. This was done without consultation with military people or looking at what service members might think about this question. Secondly, there's the president's problem with his own draft record during the Vietnam War, his avoidance of service, and the fact that he once wrote a letter to his ROTC commander at the University of Arkansas saying that he loathed the military. On top of that, you have a kind of feeling that the White House staff itself is not sympathetic or understanding of military personnel. And finally, and perhaps most important of all, because of the end of the Cold War, the military is going through a dramatic reduction in numbers and budget. Even a Ronald Reagan would have difficulties today making the kind of cutbacks that are necessary in a post-Cold War era. But when you put all those four things together, this is what accounts for the president's unique tensions as a commander-in-chief with the serving members of his armed forces.
Do you think the military is making some very basic changes, and it appears more and more that military leadership resists intervention? I'm thinking of places like Somalia, places like Bosnia, where it seems that military brass is putting the brakes on any kind of U.S. intervention there.
Historically, contrary to popular and conventional thinking, the military has always been much less hawkish than civilian leaders. This goes back to Korea. It goes back to Vietnam. The military knows that its own people are going to be killed in these kinds of situations. The Somali intervention is an interesting one. I was there in late February and early March. At that time, it looked like we were doing a decent job, although the military was reluctant in the first place. But events since that time, when that Somali operation fell under United Nations control, has really gotten out of hand. Where we were there formerly on a humanitarian mission, we now seem to be on a mission of chasing down warlords and actually shooting Somalis, for which I can find no rationale. And in a sense, you might say the military may have been justified in its earlier caution. Of course, that was under President Bush, and then continued by then-elected President Clinton.
Well, I know that you talked to soldiers in Somalia about what their life was like, what conditions were like for them there. What did they tell you?
The soldiers going to Somalia believed that they were going there for a humanitarian mission, and most were quite upbeat about it. This was also for black American soldiers, male and female, a major point in their life because they were, in a sense, symbolically returning to an African homeland that they'd never seen but had heard much about. I might add, just parenthetically here, the percentage of women soldiers on the American force in Somalia is double that of what it was in the Gulf. About 12% of our, at the time I was there, were female, compared to only 6% female during the Gulf War. Yet we've heard very little bit about women soldiers in Somalia because there have been no problems. I mean, the big story is there is no story. Now, what was interesting about Somalia was we had 24,000 American military personnel in that country on the 1st of March. We had killed two people in excessive force. These were Somali youth who had stolen things from Americans and gotten shot by American soldiers and killed. We don't even know how many people were killed by the Nigerians, the Botswanans, the Moroccans, the Pakistanis. We know the Canadians, with only 800, killed four, in excess of four. The Italians killed 12. These were much smaller contingents than the Americans. And the question arises, why did the Americans have such a low rate of violence toward the local Somalis?
What's your answer?
And I think the answer is that we were the only multiracial army there. The monochromatic chromatic armies, if I can make up such a word, I mean, the all-white armies like the Belgians, the French, the Italians, or the brown armies like the Pakistanis and the Moroccans, or the black armies like the Botswanans and the Nigerians, were much more violent toward the locals than the Americans. And I think we were the only country suitable for that role because black and white soldiers had had more experience on multiracial issues, kept an eye on each other, and generally were well-behaved. Our soldiers certainly were unhappy at Somali incursions, petty thievery, taunting that was continuously going on, but they maintained a high level of discipline, which is the mark of a true professional soldier. I was quite proud of those men and women, and I'm quite disappointed to see that American forces are involved in shooting Somalis in a United Nations operation. I'm a skeptic of the UN. I mean,
I can hear that. I can hear that. I want to shift gears and talk about South Africa, and I know you just returned from South Africa, where you were working with the defense ministry and the ANC on integrating the armed forces there. Who invited you?
I was invited by the United States Information Service and the Institute for Defense Policy of South Africa to consult with the African National Congress, ANC, which is the Nelson Mandela political party, and the South African Defense Force, which is the existing. The issues were several and very interesting in South Africa. They were interested because of my work in racial relations in the American Army and wanted to know what lessons, if any, might be drawn for South Africa in a post-apartheid era. As most of us know, in April 1994, there'll be elections, and presumably, though this can't be foretold with exact certainty, Nelson Mandela will be the next president of South Africa.
You're predicting that?
Well, most South Africans are, but you know, it's not a done deal. What you have to think here is you have a South African Defense Force currently, which is technically proficient, but does not enjoy the legitimacy, you know, of the black population. Indeed, it's viewed as an enemy in most cases. Though at the lower ranks, it's about half black, but its officer corps, you know, it does have some minorities in the so-called colored of Cape Town area, the Indians who are descended from Indians from India, but it's basically a white officered military.
So
how do you bring in blacks and the guerrilla army of the ANC into it is the issue of the day. I think it can be done, and I'm, you know, as I tell everybody, nervously optimistic that this can be pulled off.
Well, what were some of your suggestions to them about how to integrate then the upper levels of the defense force in South Africa?
Yeah. The upper levels, let's say generals and above, there have to be some lateral entry from the ANC side. Some of their senior military people will have to simply be placed in some senior jobs there as generals. The lower levels will be relatively easy because you can just bring in second lieutenants and young lieutenants, black as well as white, and in the natural course of events, they'll be trained and work their way up the system. The lower enlisted ranks, again, won't be much of a problem, except you'll find the end of conscription, which presently exists in South Africa for whites only, will mean that the South African lower ranks will become heavily black in the not-too-distant future. The real problem that arises in South African military is how to integrate the middle levels, which in American terminology would be something like majors and colonels, because these people are not going to be getting out shortly as the senior people will. They're not working their way up through the system as the junior people will be doing. That's where the tough decisions will be made. And one way of handling this, of course, is that the South African white officer corps sees itself as technically proficient military professionals and view the what's called the MK, that's the military arm of the ANC, as just being political types. On the other hand, the MK view the South African officers as not having any credibility in the larger society, taking part in nefarious operations, not being very professional when it comes down to behaving properly in townships and in violence directed against blacks. The way of handling that, and it's not easy, obviously, but many of these black future middle-level officers can get professional training, I think, overseas, including America. Mm. But many are already going to places like India. Many had went to former communist countries like East Germany and Russia were notable. But they can go to India, the United States, the United Kingdom, places of this sort, get military training if they don't trust the South African Defense Force that currently exists. And these then can be integrated, I think, into a system of a fairly equal treatment. I might add, when I said I was nervously optimistic, I found some remarkable amounts of goodwill on both the white and on the black side. And with a little give and take, I think this thing can be integrated. And then you'll have a military which will be racially integrated. And like America, might be the only other military suitable for peacekeeping roles in a multiracial context.
How, and I know that you've looked at racial issues in the U.S. military. How analogous would you say U.S. military or U.S. race relations are to South Africa race relations?
Well, there's two big differences, and then there's one similarity. One big difference is that we integrated a minority into a majority institution. Blacks, of course, make up only 11 to 12% of our population. So that was one, while blacks make up 70+% of the population of South Africa. The second is that our American military, by and large, enjoys the legitimacy of the people it serves, including the black community as well as the white community. This is not true of the South African Defense Force, which does not enjoy credibility with the vast majority of that country's population. So those are two big differences. The similarity, though, is that our American military integrated not because it was trying to do the morally correct thing, but because it simply had to do it. It was a necessity to have an effective military which would enjoy legitimacy in a larger society and perform better. That's the same in South Africa. Its military is going to have to integrate if it wants to enjoy the credibility and legitimacy of the broad sector of that community and at the same time remain technically proficient. Now, there are going to be extremist groups on the left and on the right, extreme rightists on the white side, extreme leftists on the black side, who just won't be able to live with that situation, and hopefully that this new racially integrated middle-of-the-road and politically legitimate military system will be able to outride these kind of extremists on the left and on the right.
Well, we covered a lot of territory, and I thank you for joining us today on Fresh Air.
My pleasure, Marty.
Charles Moskos is a military sociologist and teaches at Northwestern University. I'm Marty Moskowain, and this is Fresh Air.